Easter Sunday, a reading from the Holy Gospel according to John chapter 20 verses 1 to 9. It was very early on the first day of the week and still dark when Mary of Magdala came to the tomb. She saw that the stone had been moved away from the tomb and came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved. "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb," she said, "and we don't know where they have put him." So Peter set out with the other disciple to go to the tomb. They ran together, but the other disciple, running faster than Peter, reached the tomb first. He bent down and saw the linen cloths lying on the ground, but did not go in. Simon Peter, who was following, now came up, went right into the tomb, saw the linen cloths on the ground, and also the cloth that had been over his face. This was not with the linen cloths, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went in. He saw and he believed. Till this moment they had failed to understand the teaching of Scripture, that he must rise from the dead.
It is Easter Sunday morning. Maria Valtorta describes a scene near the house of the Last Supper after John has returned to the house with a remorseful Peter. In a street near the house, the women disciples are discussing which way they will go to the sepulchre. Mary Magdalene announces that she will go ahead and bribe the guards, if necessary, to get through. "Are you going all alone, Mary? I'll come with you," says Martha, who is afraid for her sister. "No, you will go with Mary of Alphaeus to Johannes. Salome and Susanna will wait for you near the gate outside the walls, and then you will all come together along the main road." And Mary Magdalene cuts other possible comments short as she goes away quickly with her bag full of balms and her money in her breast. She flies so fast she goes along the road in the first pink shade of dawn. She goes in by the judicial gate to be quicker, and no one stops her. It is at this moment that a short but strong earthquake takes place, creating a panic again in the people of Jerusalem, who are still terrorized by the events of Friday. The Magdalene is just on the border of the path that takes one to the kitchen garden of Joseph of Arimathea, when she is caught in the powerful and also harmonious roar of this heavenly sign. Meanwhile, in the faint rosy light of dawn that is advancing in the sky, a very bright light appears and descends like an incandescent, wonderful globe, cutting the calm air in a zigzag course. Mary of Magdala is almost grazed and thrown on the ground by it. She bends for a moment, whispering, "My Lord!" And then she straightens up like a stork after the wind has passed by, and she runs towards the kitchen garden even faster. She enters it quickly and goes towards the sepulchre in the rock, as fast as a bird that is chased and is looking for its nest. But no matter how fast she runs, she cannot be there when the heavenly meteor acts as a lever and as a flame on the seal of lime placed as a reinforcement for the heavy stone. And she is too late for the final crashing collapse of the stone door. This causes such a shake that, joined with the earthquake, although this is of a short duration, is so violent it knocks the guards down as if they were dead. When Mary arrives, she sees the useless jailers thrown on the ground like a sheaf of mown corn. Mary Magdalene does not associate the earthquake with the resurrection, but looking at the spectacle, she thinks it is a punishment of God for the desecrators of Jesus' sepulchre. She falls on her knees saying, "Alas, they've stolen him!" She is really disconsolate and weeps like a little girl who has come sure that she would find her father whom she was looking for, and instead finds the house empty. She then stands up and runs away to go to Peter and John. Thinking of nothing but of informing the two, she forgets to go and meet her companions on the road. Instead, as fast as a gazelle, she goes back the way she came. She passes through the judicial gate. She flies through the streets, which are a little more crowded, and she rushes against the door of the hospitable house and knocks at it furiously. The mistress opens the door to her. Panting, Mary Magdalene asks, "Where are John and Peter?" "There," says the woman, pointing at the supper room. Mary of Magdala enters, and standing before the two astonished men, in her voice kept low out of pity for the mother, there is more anguish than if she had shouted, she says, "They've taken the Lord away from the sepulchre. I wonder where they've put him." And for the first time, she staggers, is unsteady, and in order not to fall, she holds on to whatever she can. "What? What are you saying?" asked the two. And still panting, she replies, "I went ahead to bribe the guards so that they would let us go. They are there like dead bodies. The sepulchre is open and the stone is on the ground. Who did it? Oh, come, let us run." Peter and John set out at once. Mary follows them for a few steps, then she goes back. She seizes the mistress of the house. She shakes her, violent in her far-sighted love, and she says in her face, "Mind you do not let anybody go to her." And she points at the door of the mother's room. "Remember that I am your mistress. Obey and be silent." Then she leaves her, aghast, and joins the apostles, who are running towards the sepulchre. Peter and John, followed by the Magdalene, have arrived at the garden, and John, who runs faster, is the first to arrive at the sepulchre. The guards are no longer there. John, timid and sorrowful, kneels down at the open entrance to venerate and to get some indication from the things he sees. But he only sees, heaped on the floor, the linen cloths placed on the shroud. "There is really nothing, Simon. Mary has seen accurately. Come, come in, look." Peter, who is breathless after so much running, goes into the sepulchre. On the way, he had said, "I will never dare to approach that place." But now he thinks only of finding out where the Master may be. And he calls him, as if he might find him concealed in some dark corner. At this early hour in the morning, it is still very dark in the deep sepulchre, which receives light only from the opening of the entrance, where John and the Magdalene now cast a shadow. Peter finds it hard to see, and has to help himself with his hands to ascertain what the situation is. He touches, trembling, the table of the anointment, and feels that it is empty. "He is not here, John. He's not here. Oh, come here. I've wept so much. I can hardly see in this poor light." John stands up and goes in, and while he does so, Peter discovers the sedarium in the corner, folded diligently, with the shroud rolled up carefully inside. "They've really abducted him," says John. "The guards were not here for us, but to do that, and we've let them do it. By going away, we've allowed it." "Oh, where will they have put him?" asks Peter. "Peter, Peter," says John, "this is really the end." The two disciples come out, looking annihilated. "Let us go, woman. You will tell the mother." "I'm not going away," says the Magdalene. "I'm staying here. Somebody will come." "Oh, I'm not coming. There is still something of him here." The mother was right. To breathe the air where he was is the only relief left to us. The only relief, says Peter. Now you also can see that it was nonsense to hope. Mary does not even reply to him. She crouches on the ground, close to the entrance, and weeps, while the others go away slowly. It is some time after Pentecost Sunday, and Mary and John have taken up residence in a little house in Gethsemane, in land owned by Lazarus. One night, there is a knock at the door. A lamp is lit, and a faint flickering light filters through a crack in the door. A hand opens, a head looks out, and a voice, John's, asks, "Who are you?" "Joseph of Arimathea, and with me are Nicodemus and Lazarus. The hour is indiscreet, but prudence has forced it upon us. We have brought something for Mary." "Come in," says John. "I will go and call her. She's not sleeping. She's praying up there in her little room on the terrace." John calls Mary, and Lazarus tells her that they have brought a shroud with them. Nicodemus says, "This shroud was on him from the evening of preparation day until the dawn of the resurrection, and it must come to you. I am warning you so that you might not be too deeply moved in seeing it, and you must be informed that the more the days passed, the more clearly his image appeared on it, just as he was after being washed. When we collected it from the sepulchre, it seemed that it simply retained the impression of his members covered with the oils. And mixed with the oils, the drainage of blood and serum from so many wounds. But either through a natural process, or, which is much more certain, by a supernatural will, it is now a miracle of him to give joy to you. The more time passed, the more precise and clear the impression has become. He is there on the cloth, handsome, imposing, even if wounded, serene and peaceful, even after so many tortures. Have you the courage to see it?" Mary replies, joining her hands against her heart, "Oh, Nicodemus, that was my supreme desire. You say that his appearance is peaceful? Oh, to be able to see him like this, not with the tortured expression that is on Nike's veil." The four men shift the table to have more room, and then as Lazarus and John stand on one side, Nicodemus and Joseph on the other, they slowly unfold the long cloth. The rear side appears first, beginning from the feet, and then after the quasi-junction of the heads, the front side. The lines are very clear, and clear are the signs, all the signs of the scourging, crowning with thorns, rubbing of the cross, and bruises caused by blows received or by falls, and the wounds of the nails and of the lance. Mary falls on her knees. She kisses the cloth. She caresses those impressions. She kisses the wounds. She is distressed, but visibly happy to be able to have that supernatural, miraculous image of him. And she says, "He is serene, in peace by now, in his mortal sleep. He already seems to be feeling the life that is coming back and the glory that no one will ever be able to strike and demolish. I now wish nothing else apart from being reunited to him. But that will happen when and as God has predisposed." She takes the shroud reverently after the four have folded it, and she goes out of the kitchen and quickly climbs the little staircase. Jesus has a message through Maria Valtorta for those who doubt the shroud's authenticity. He says, "You have seen the wreath of bruises around my kidneys. The proof of my suffering is in the Turin shroud. Your scientists, to offer proof for their incredulity regarding the shroud, explain the manner in which blood, sweat from the corpse, and an overstrained body, being mixed with the aromas, were able to produce that natural painting of my lifeless, tortured body. The fierce wounds to my kidneys were the most powerful chemical agent in the miracle of the Turin shroud. My kidneys, nearly shattered by the scourges, were no longer able to function. Like those of people burned in a blaze, they were unable to filter. And the urea accumulated and spread throughout my blood and my body caused the sufferings of uremic intoxication and of the reagent transuding from my corpse, which fixed the impression upon the cloth. Whoever among you is a doctor, or whoever among you is ill with uremia, can grasp the sufferings which the uremic toxins must have caused me. They were so abundant as to leave an indelible imprint. After death, when the agony had ceased and fluids had been partially emptied out, both naturally and from the lance thrust, my face suddenly thinned. My mother's tears also served to restore a more habitual appearance to my face. But on the Turin shroud, the face of someone dead for several hours appears. The usual process of edema had already begun, all the more intense in someone killed with torture like me. It is the transudates spreading from the serous membranes which make you say that a dead person looks the way he did when alive. It is the great pacification which death extends over even the most tortured faces. In addition, consider that the image appears on a cloth and is fixed upon it through a process of natural aromas and salts. You know that any stain on a cloth appears prone to expand. But in reality, the features of my face on the morning of the resurrection, that is, when I ceased to be covered by the Turin shroud, were swollen in that way. Life returned to the living one. But during those 40 hours I was quite dead, and in no way different from every man who is a prey to death. I did not decompose because of the swift resurrection, but my body was subject to the rules common to dead bodies, especially those dying of innumerable wounds. I, as victim, wanted to annihilate myself in this respect too. All decomposition begins with swelling. Let this be directed to all who still have doubts about the truth of my death.